Started late, we're already ahead of schedule. The reason many, if not all of us, are here, Dr. Alan Kay.
Thanks. I usually give multimedia presentation with lots of images, but I decided to give a straight talk today for a couple of reasons. One is that there are already lots of images around, and unlike most of the places that I give talks at, they're actually workshops. And workshops are a much, much better way to deal with what we usually try to show in demonstrations. The other thing is that the best medium for this talk would be an essay. There are some essays on the Squeakland site, and I'm going to turn this talk into an essay after I find out what I'm going to say in the next few minutes. But part of it is because one of the nice things about words as opposed to images is that they allow people to come up with their own. Imagination is actually the ability to create images. And we live in a society which tries to servo our imaginations. Television is a thing that tries to tell us what to imagine because it's flooding us with so many images, it's hard to think of images of our own. I think that's a bad thing. In Squeak, we can create images. That's pretty good. One of the reasons we don't give the kids clip art is because the Squeak eToys is not a productivity tool where the goal is to get from A to B as quickly as possible. What we want the kids to do is to aim for B, and like all good educational processes, wind up at C because they're not the same person anymore. So the difference between training and education is training tries to add something to what's already there, and education tries to change what's there. Marketing tries to find out who people are and cater to what they desire, and education tries to find out who people are and change them. Right? So we're in the changing business, and the changing business that we're in is part of a grand tradition that has to do with different ways of using language that go all the way back before we knew how humans use language before they started writing it down. And the closest analogy to what we're trying to do is to the printing press. And the good news is, if you know the history of the printing press, is that it completely changed the Western world. Completely transformed it from one kind of thing that had been around for thousands of years, and the best of that was embodied by what the Greeks did. And it changed it into the last 400 years of our modern life. So that's the good news. And that's the kind of thing we should be aspiring to. The not bad news, but sobering news, that if we follow the path of the printing press successfully with the computer, then all of us will be long dead before any real changes are apparent. Because it took about 150 years to go from 1450 to the beginning of the 17th century, where the real changes in thought became apparent. And you could look at it as a necessary progression. There's a fellow by the name of Clay Christensen who wrote a book called The Innovator's Dilemma. And his book is basically an apology for managers and corporations who can't deal with innovation. And the other way of looking at it is, well, what are managers and corporations paid to do? So maybe they should handle innovation better. We could point at the education system as well. And I just had a very short conversation with one of the people from the Dewey School, the lab school, which is, Dewey is one of the intellectual parents of this effort. And for people who have followed the progress of the Dewey ideas, and he was a kind of a soulmate with Montessori. They both believed in many of the same kinds of things, and Dewey was also regarded for a long time as America's leading philosopher, not just as an educator. So he was a wide-ranging person and had some extremely important ideas about education, which in fact were implemented fairly widely for a while. And then the Dewey movement gradually became marginalized. And it's very important for us to understand why it became marginalized and is now a bit of a curiosity today. You see it in a few places, and there are, like with Montessori education in the United States, there are vastly many more places that claim to be Montessori or Dewey schools than actually embody any of the ideas of either of those two people, because it became a kind of a brand name for a certain way of looking at things. And so the marginalization of Dewey's approach to education, somewhat similar to what happened to Logo a little over 20 years ago, which also had a vogue, became widely spread, and then became marginalized, happened because essentially the enthusiasts and the first round of adopters made it look like it was going to be a relatively easy process. And they weren't thinking about the idea that if you take any group of people, maybe 5 to 10% are early adopters, and you can get almost anything going with these 10%. But the other 90% are composed of much, much larger factions that have very, very different reasons for doing almost anything. And about 80% of the population requires almost everybody else to agree with an idea before they will agree with an idea. So this takes, if you can think of this as a bunch of, you know, a gas with almost all of the atoms stationary and just a few high energy particles, and just think of how many bouncing around have to be done before you get all of the particles kind of moving, can take, well, 150 years, which is what the printing press took, even though 50 years after the printing press, the famous printer Aldus, by the way, made books the size we have them today. The Gutenberg Bible, if you've ever seen them, were big books, because manuscripts were big books, and Gutenberg imitated the handwritten fonts so exactly that there were actually 253 characters in the Gutenberg font, where today we would have maybe 80 or so. But he imitated every ligature and every abbreviation, everything, so that a Gutenberg book would look as much like a handwritten book as possible, except as was noted at the Nuremberg Book Fair 1454, the books were amazingly similar. So people would look at this page and then go to the next page. That had never happened before. The other thing about the Gutenberg books is they're really expensive. Even though they were factors of 20 or 30 cheaper than a handwritten book. So in today's dollars, a handwritten book would be $2 or $3 million for a Bible. In fact, they would have jewels on the cover, because the jewels are much less expensive than the book itself. And it's hard to figure out exactly how much a Gutenberg book was sold for in today's dollars, but they said it was 3 years of a clerk's wages. So that could be $60,000 or $70,000, which is an incredible change from millions. So it meant that communities and individuals could own these Gutenberg books. But part of the expense of a Gutenberg book was all the illuminations, which, by the way, were put in there by hand. So they had this cheap process of printing these Gutenberg Bibles, but they didn't look quite right, so they had people to go in and do all the fancy artwork. They were called rubicators, because most of the letters were done in red, so they rubicated these books to make them look like real books. And 40 years later, a scholar by the name of Aldus Manutius decided to set up a press in Venice. And one of his ideas was that printing could be really cheap, providing you didn't use so much paper. And so he started thinking about smaller books that you could carry around. So he decided the first set of things from his press would be called the Portable Library. And he determined to print 40 or 50 titles. And he sent his sons around Europe to gather up material, not just material, but to gather up material written by the Romans. Then Aldus had this problem, is that there were no fonts in printing 50 years later that were legible. in a small book. So Aldus actually invented modern typography along with a couple of other early printers to make 12-point fonts. And his type cutter was the one who adapted the Roman sized characters to make an uppercase and a lowercase. So when you use Times Roman on Microsoft Word, you're using something that was originally Aldus in order to make a 12-point font that people could read. And he invented the idea of italics, which he thought made things look rather nice and graceful. So there's all this extra stuff. Then he decided the book should be this size, which is the normal 6x9-inch page that we're used to. And why did he pick that? Well, he went out and measured saddlebags in Venice to find out what size a book should be so that somebody could put it in their saddlebag. Because he realized that if he did all of these things, a book could actually get down to about $100 and that must be losable. All right, so this is an important demarcation in any kind of technology. So today, if you're lying in the pool reading a book on a little raft and a 12-year-old comes and turns you over and the book goes down to the bottom, for most books you might be reading, it's not a tragedy. In fact, you might be reading might be even a good idea. But at worst, you can go out to a bookstore and get another cheap copy for $10 or $15. If you were doing this with any of your laptop computers and the 12-year-old overturns you and the laptop computer goes to the bottom of the pool, you would not be happy. Because number one, they aren't what we used to call, they aren't set up to pass the Navy test. The Navy test, we found out what it was years ago at MIT when an admiral was being shown this great new interactive system, Nicholas Negroponte's lab. He was being sponsored by the Navy, and the admiral asked, well, will this work at sea? And Nicholas said, of course it will. And the admiral tossed his cup of coffee at it, and it failed the Navy test. So if you think of the Navy test as an interesting demarcation, and the whether you can lose the thing as an interesting demarcation, we can see that personal computing has not yet completely invented, right? We're basically in the stage in printing between Gutenberg and Aldus, and also with regard to content, because the content between Gutenberg and Aldus was mostly about Bibles. It's mostly about printing Bibles in the vernacular in various ways. And a few printers got executed for doing this, some famous martyrs to the new technology of printing, because for different reasons in different countries. And so basically what the press was doing was finding a way of automating a manuscript technology that was devoted to a set of ideas that had been around since the early Middle Ages. And if you look at what people use computers for today, it's mostly automating old ideas that have been around for the last 300 or 400 years, namely books or magazines, as in the case of the web. The web is kind of a magazine. So the thing that the computer can really do, which is to make dynamic models of complex and powerful ideas, almost nobody does. And so the question is whether we'll all be dead before most people do. If you talk to educators in various areas about this idea, they think it's preposterous. And they think it's preposterous in exactly the same way that people thought that ordinary people would learn to read and write in the year 1400. There are professionals who did this, and it was thought to be a profession. Just like after a few hundred years of printing, there are professionals who laid out books and did stuff. So when we invented desktop publishing at Xerox PARC, it was thought to be an empty gesture. Nobody would use it. And the theory that nobody would use it was based on the fact that nobody was doing it then, right? And if you extrapolate with a ruler, right, zero, you get zero. So this is a problem. Even the guy who was head of Digital Equipment Corporation, a very big mainframe company that no longer exists, said even into the 80s that nobody had any real use for a personal computer, right? In spite of the fact that they were happening all around him. And that company is now gone. It got acquired by a personal computer company a few years later. So the problem of thinking about the future is partly a problem of escaping from the present. And we tend to think about the present and the future solely in terms of the past. It's almost impossible for us to do otherwise, because all of our experience, all of our judgment, and in fact, as I'll talk about in a second, all of our pre-wiring is set up to use the acquired and accumulated wisdom of a culture in making decisions about the future. This is why traditional cultures are so static, because basically they have found a way of surviving. And especially if the culture doesn't have writing, they put an enormous amount of use of language into remembering the various rituals that they've come up with for survival and propagating these rituals. And those of you who perhaps have studied Homeric verse, the Iliad and the Odyssey, as they were originally written, will realize that this is an oral culture that was later transcribed, as indeed are parts of the Bible. And the most interesting thing about pure oral cultures is the amount of repetition that you find in all of the, very much like rap music, which is an oral culture being recapitulated. And the amount of repetition is there, and the amount of rhythmic stress is there in order to help memory. And so the rhetoric is about 90% or more devoted to helping memory, and only 10% devoted to content. And so the tendency is to endlessly recapitulate the things that are known to work and get them to be remembered and used by the new generation. When writing came in, it changed things tremendously, even in manuscript writing. When printing came in, it changed things in the largest qualitative way that we can describe. So the